This conference will now be recorded.
It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Miami, Florida. Adam Schwartz manages Black Bear Value Partners. He has 16 years of buy-side investment experience in a variety of themes, including equities, structured products, corporate credit, and capital structure arbitrage. Prior to founding the firm, Adam served as a director and senior member of the investment team at Firtree Partners. He was also an analyst at Liberty View Capital Management and Core Advisors. Adam received his BS and MS with a concentration in accounting from Washington University in St. Louis. On behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Adam. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John, and thanks for having me on the participate in this program. I've listened to a lot of fellow members of the community and their presentations, and they have been enormously helpful. As you know, your publication and interviews have been in my investment process. So thank you. So today we're going to talk a little bit about credit ETFs. They've gotten a bit more focus probably in the media in the latter part of the year, and we're just going to talk about some of the ways that they're structured poorly, the ways that the problems that they pose to the system, and I'd encourage anyone who wants to follow up and discuss it, feel free. My contact information is at the end, so you can reach out and we can talk about it if I don't cover something in detail today. I'm going to start in some capacity a little bit basic, and then I'll get a little bit more focused as we move along the presentation. Very quickly, a little bit of background on Black Bear. So I started it a couple of years ago after spending most of my career at Firtree Partners, which was a $13 billion AUM investment manager. And while I was at Firtree, I spent my time pretty much across all different types of asset classes and industries, and focused a lot both on the long side and the short side, across equities and credit. And so this kind of idea is something that I would have looked at or worked on while I was there. The idea when I started Black Bear was kind of simple. I wanted to create a partnership that was very low fee and that sort of was a bit different than the way that hedge funds in general have been created of late, which in my opinion is very, very high fees for the manager, and some lack of alignment between the manager and their LPs. And I wanted to create something where there was tremendous amount of alignment, so significant personal investment, low fees, and basically where the manager, me, isn't paid a kind of an appearance fee for just for showing up. But, and so I think that the market is gravitating in that direction, and that was really the kind of the idea of starting the partnership and finding great long-term LPs that want to invest for the long haul together with me, where we can invest together, and to also create a business with lower expenses so that we didn't have to spend lots of time on the road marketing and raising money. We could focus on compounding our capital together and finding good LPs. The ideas in terms of the investment approach is probably similar to others that are listening to this. We're very concentrated. We focus on our best ideas. And typically, it's definitely more of a long biased fund. And typically, I stay away from sort of single name equity shorts, though I don't say I'll never do them. I do them a lot less. This is a little bit different in the sense that I'm talking about a short idea, but this is a little bit more thematic and is a very large very, very large percentage of our fund's assets from the standpoint of our potential upside. I like to find ideas, especially when you're shorting, where you can lose a little and make a lot. I think that's a pretty good way of finding asymmetry. So let's talk about credit ETFs and why people like them. A lot of times people focus on how, why their idea will work. And I think a big area to focus on is why people believe it in the first place. And so some of these beliefs about credit ETFs have been challenged recently. And I would tell you, this is an idea that I've been involved in differing amounts over the last, you know, year or so, year and a half. And it's increased in size. And, you know, a year and a half ago, there was I was challenged on almost all of these. And sure enough, as time has gone on and people have seen some of the weaknesses, that some of these are a little bit more accepted. But people generally think they like bond ETFs because bonds don't lose money. They think that ETFs are super liquid, the fees are low, and these are passive vehicles. And passive has been, you know, maybe prior to December, considered a foolproof way to invest. Additionally, when you invest in these securities, it's you get positive carry, so you get a coupon. You get diversity from equities, so people think they're not taking equity-like risk. I would posit that you're actually taking equity-like risk with really terrible prospective returns. And you know, generally speaking, and this part is kind of true, that individual bonds are hard to buy for retail customers. So if you want a more diversified portfolio of bonds, this is an easier way to do it. And I would say that that's partly true. But in general, these assumptions are, you know, create securities that look good at first glance to some, but they can be very devastating to your portfolio. And, you know, Black Bear is short a variety of different ETFs, and it's not just high yield. It's high yield, it's investment grade, it's leveraged loans, it's emerging market debt. The concepts that we're going to talk about today apply in some form or another to all of those different areas. And the interesting part about it is that I've gone through a little bit of I don't know if the right word is genesis or evolution is the right word. I've gone through a bit of an evolution where originally I was really focused on high yield, and we'll talk about that. But I've become even more constructive on the short side on investment grade, where I think it's really a wolf in sheep's clothing that can be potentially even more devastating than high yield, since people do have some assumption that high yield is lower quality. Investment grade is not too far behind and really not getting paid great yields. So rough stats on high yield ETFs, and this is now, you know, things have changed over the last, you know, couple of months as spreads have widened. Right now, it's about a 7 to 7.5% gross yield. The bonds have a 4-year duration. And so compared to the 4 or 5 year treasury, that's about a 500 basis point spread to treasuries. But the important thing to realize is when you look at one of these ETFs, they're showing you a gross yield. And the reality is there are losses that will happen. And so you have to subtract those losses, and historical loss rates for high yield are around 2% net of recoveries. So the real yield you're buying it at is somewhere around 5 to 5.5%, which is more like a 300 or so basis point spread to treasuries. One thing that I'll show you later, is there have been virtually no defaults for the last, you know, few years, really since the financial crisis, because rates have been really low and everyone's been able to avoid default, you know, maybe some retailers, some energy companies. But other than that, pretty much any company that's been sick has been able to refinance and sort of delay potentially an inevitable loss. So you've had very, very low loss rates, much lower than 2%, virtually nil. If you have any sort of reversion to the mean and the sick companies eventually do what they're supposed to do and go out of business because they can't satisfy their debt, the loss rates could be a lot higher, and you could be looking at you know, yields that instead of a 5% net yield, you could be really looking at something more like a 1-3% loss adjusted yield, which means that you're buying it at virtually no spread or even a negative spread to treasuries. The credit breakdown for this, as you can see, is all junk. It's all stuff that's, you know, below investment grade. Investment grade bonds we'll talk about next. And this to me has been, I've been spending a lot of time on this, and it's been a focus. And I think you'll see why. So investment grade bonds right now are about a 4% yield. They're an 8-year duration, so they're long bonds. So you are taking interest rate risk, and you're taking you know, the premium risk, you know, over, you know, the spread to treasuries. On a gross basis, it's about 140 basis point spread to treasuries. Again, there are losses even with an investment grade. And if you look across like an average investment grade, the losses are about 50, could be about 50 basis points, which means that you're buying it at around a 3.5% net yield, which is about an 80 basis point spread to the 10-year. Now, when you look at this and you go into an ETF, and I'd encourage anyone who's doing this, you know, I would say, I didn't kind of issue the disclaimer. I would encourage everyone, do your own work. I make mistakes. And so I would encourage you all, if you're looking at this, to click on an investment grade ETF and look at what you see. And what you'll see are issuers that should not make you nervous. You're going to see the top issuers are the JP Morgans and Goldmans and Apples and Microsofts, et cetera. These are not names that would cause the average investor to be concerned. And really, they don't cause me a whole lot of concern. What I think is a little bit misleading is that these ETFs are set up in a barbell structure. And barbell structures can be very, very dangerous because they create the illusion of a safe security on average, but you really have two securities. You have half of the portfolio that's, you know, basically A or better, and then you have the other half, which is triple B or worse. And so, you know, what we learned, you know, I was pretty involved with mortgage bonds and the housing issues in 06, 07, 08, 09, and beyond. What you saw was this product called Alt-A. And what Alt-A was were borrowers who were not bad enough to be considered subprime, but they weren't good enough to be prime anyway. They were sort of in between. They were one layoff, you know, and maybe 3 or 4 months from having a problem if financial circumstances changed for them. They remind me a lot of these triple Bs. They're good. They're okay. The companies are performing okay. But, you know, if there's any sort of recession, if there's a slowdown, let's say there's not a recession, but there's margin compression. I think that there are just a lot of questions that aren't being asked, and people are sort of making the assumption that we need a recession for triple Bs to have problems. I don't know if that's necessarily true, because these are companies that are triple B right now operating at pretty robust economic conditions with peak margins. And if either one of those gets a little bit tricky, it could just be a little bit challenging. And you could see, you know, if you looked at General Electric, that was a name that everyone was very comfortable with for 50 years. And, you know, as they've had problems, they sort of plummeted through the ratings. So you got to be very careful in any sort of securitization, any sort of structure, when you have barbell, because you're only as strong as kind of your weakest link. And the 50% of the borrowers here that are triple B or worse are something that, you know, should be treated with an abundance of caution. I want to talk a little bit about how the sausage gets made, how these structures function, how they are created. And the reason why is because many times in history, people look at situations and they take things for granted. They, you know, I've said this to people before, there are certain things that people take as a truth, and it may not be a truth. And a perfect example was the housing crisis, where anyone who wasn't constructive on housing, you know, I wasn't very constructive on it, was basically told housing never goes down. And that was mostly true, except when it wasn't, it was devastating. And you needed to question the, you know, why things are the way that they are. And if you sometimes challenge these truths and challenge and look for weaknesses, you may not find one. And maybe it may actually be true. But sometimes you'll find a kink in the armor or a chink in the armor, and you'll be in a situation where if you're right or if that weakness comes to bear, you could make a lot of money without risking very much. The other thing is it helps you avoid making mistakes. So I think generally in anyone's investment process, they should take time that anytime they're glossing over something and taking something as a given, spend that extra few minutes to examine what their underlying thesis is on a lot of different things and think about it deeply. And if you're still satisfied with the answer, that's great. And if you find a weakness in the argument, maybe that's even better because you can move on to something that's a little bit easier and safer. So taking a step back, you know, what are bonds? Bonds are securities issued by companies. They borrow your money. They promise they're going to pay you back principal, and they're going to give you interest. And then they create these rules that are called covenants. And you know, I think most people are familiar with covenants, but the way that I've described it to people outside of the investment community is it's like a prenuptial agreement between the borrower and the company, or the borrower and the lender. And it's basically what's going to govern the agreement if things don't go to plan. So if the company has problems, or they need to borrow more money, or they need to do something, they go to the covenants, and those are the rules within the Indian indenture that say what the company is allowed to do and what they have to do. And it's, I've put some examples of here. So it's how much they can borrow, where the claim falls, how much cash they have to have to cover their interest, et cetera. And then the bonds are sold to investors. And then the ETFs, for example, you know, they're just one, buy them and stick them into their structure. You know, Howard Marks, who is a remarkable investor and has always, you know, in my opinion, one of the most thoughtful investors, people really out there, you know, had this quote where he said, true liquidity is how easily you can sell an asset and at what price when you're forced to. I think a lot of investors, especially people who believe in the system, sort of assume a liquid marketplace most of the time. And I think that anyone with experience in credit knows that even when the banks were providing proprietary trading flow, which they're not really anymore, credit can get very, very illiquid very quickly. And it can be quite uncomfortable for people who need liquidity. And I don't think that these securities have really been tested in a meaningful way. So we'll see what happens. This is a little bit of a busy chart, and I'm going to go through some highlights of it. But the way to think about the ETF creation redemption process this is kind of the flow of how the bonds and the units are created. And when I was looking at it, I spent a lot of time reading through the indentures, just trying to see how the relationship worked. You know, if it was a one-way thing when they were buying bonds, how did it work? How would it work if they wanted to sell bonds? So buying bonds is easy. So the ETF gets, you know, has cash, they buy bonds, and in good times, you know, there's no problems. There's no problem usually when you're requiring cash. Companies will borrow, ETFs will buy it. It reminds me, you know, if you think about CDOs back in 2005, 2006, 2007, they had lots of abundant capital, and they were buying lots of bonds and sticking them in their structures, and there was no problem, obviously. When you sell an ETF, so if I were to own, if I owned an ETF and I wanted to sell it, I need a bid for the ETF, and typically markets function fine. So I go to the market and I list my, you know, I have my offer, and there's tight spreads, and I sell my ETF, no problem. But when things get a little bit rockier and the market slows down, the ETF, the bid may not necessarily be there in such a tight market. And I've experienced firsthand credit markets, and we've just seen in December, you know, credit markets just got very illiquid very quickly. And so what happens is they created this function called the authorized participant, which is effectively just a special, you know, market maker, specialist, whatever term you want to use, where they sit in the middle and they're basically kind of the liquidity provider if necessary. And what I've been told is that solves the problem, that there's no problem because you have a market maker in between. And if it ever trades at a discount to net asset value of the portfolio, the market maker steps in and buys it. So the example I've used before is you have $100 worth of bonds, and let's say they're trading at a 2% discount NAV. So it's trading at 98 cents on the dollar. The market maker steps in, they buy the bonds, they buy the ETF at 98, and then what they do is they go to the issuer, JP Morgan, State Street, what have you, and they effectively give them the shares, the $100 worth of shares that they bought for 98. They get $100 of cash bonds, and then they go and sell those cash bonds into the market. And this is where I think the relationship breaks down, Because at the end of the day, all of this works terrifically, assuming the authorized participant is willing to buy the bonds at a big enough discount where they could go and sell the cash bonds into the marketplace at an enough of a return to make, you know, to make a profit. This is where I started just asking questions. And I don't want to pretend that I have the answers, but I don't think enough people are asking the questions. And people who own these securities are certainly not asking the right questions when they're wrong, or if I'm right and they're wrong. And by the way, I'm not the only one that's, you know, there's other people who've advocated this idea. And I think we're all sort of in the same camp. You know, sleeping at night, daily liquidity is what that system that we just showed with the AP is supposed to create. To me, it creates a lot of questions. I put a quote up there where, you know, Ken Lay from Enron, when he was pushed about their liquidity, he said, our liquidity is fine. As a matter of fact, it's better than fine. It's strong. There are times I'm not going to compare, you know, these great institutions to Enron because that's a stretch. But I would say that there's a little bit of a lack of, in my opinion, reality or honesty about how these things will really work if there's a big market downturn. The questions that I ask are, you know, what happens if there's limited liquidity for the underlying cash bonds? What if the authorized participant is given bonds and can't sell them? They buy them at 98 and they can't sell them at 98 plus. They have to sell them lower. What does that mean? What happens when the retail investors who own this asset and own an ETF that they expect to have liquidity is backed by bonds that are less liquid? I still can't understand how you can have one security that's promised to have liquidity and the other security doesn't have liquidity. I don't know how one can exist with the other. Another question is, you know, what bonds are the ones that are given by the issuer to the market maker? So what you've seen, if you look at ETFs over the last couple of months, what you've seen is the holdings have dropped a little bit and the duration has extended, which sort of makes me wonder if when there was a little bit of a run on the bank in December, whether the stuff that they were giving to the authorized participants was the better stuff and that what's left behind within the ETFs is a little bit worse. Now, it was a small move in December. It wasn't that big of a deal. But if there's a big move, there could be an issue where the authorized participants are given the better stuff first, and what's left behind are securities that are even more illiquid and even more longer duration and worse. I still don't know who the market makers are going to sell their bonds to. So, you know, because of the Volcker Rule, prop desks at banks are not allowed to take the kinds of risk they used to. And so you've seen examples of bonds just gap down because the smart distressed investors aren't interested in buying bonds at a 3 or 4 or 5% net yield. They're going to want, you know, tens plus. So, you know, to me, there's just a long way to go before that anyone's able to find liquidity. The answer to me at the end is that the NAVs may not be trusted. The discount to NAV could be substantial, and people may get the liquidity that they want, but they may not get the price they expect. So the liquidity may be coming at a really big discount to what their expectations are. And then you have this circular trust issue. You know, markets function because everyone trusts the system works. But if people believe that that they're going to be getting a big discount to the NAV, that creates more fear at the kind of ETF holder level. They start selling more. Then the authorized participant doesn't know what they can expect in terms of how many bonds they're going to have to go, or ETFs they're going to have to go and redeem with the issuer and retire. And so they're getting panicky that they're going to get stuck with even more cash bonds they have to sell into the market. And everyone starts, you know, there's more selling at the ETF level, and there's more panic and concern at the authorized participant level, because they need to bid at bigger and bigger discounts to NAV to protect themselves. At the end of the day, I think everyone acts in their own self-interest. And so it could just wind up, the whole system could get pretty gummed up. Now we'll talk a little bit about the market in general, and then I'll show some math in terms of what it could look like and just some examples. And by the way, I would caution people, I'm not predicting the demise of ETFs. I'm not predicting the demise of corporate credit. I'm simply saying there's a lot of risk out there that's not being properly contemplated. And if things shake the wrong way, it could lead to a lot of pain. I'm not in the prediction business of saying this is an absolute. There's a range of outcomes that could happen. I just think that this range of outcomes is underappreciated, and those who are betting against could stand to do pretty well. But there are no guarantees. So when you look at on this chart, so these are all fixed income alternatives. These are a range of products. And what you'll see is over on the left, that's U.S. high yield. That's where the finger's pointing. And this is a little bit of an older chart, so things are up a little bit. But the general message is the same, which is, U.S. high yield on a gross basis look the most attractive. But when you start applying reasonable loss rates, you're sort of in the middle. And if you start applying loss rates that revert to the mean, the yields are really more on the right, and they're not that attractive. Investment grade doesn't look very attractive no matter what. You're sort of on the right side of the chart. So I think a lot of people are under this illusion because there haven't been losses that they look at a gross yield basis. And so if they looked at it on a net yield basis, it'd be a lot less attractive. Interest coverage is something that I get a lot of pushback on. And the fact is that I agree with those who say interest coverage is at really high levels. So companies are able to maintain and pay their interest. And that's been largely true. And you won't get any argument from me. But I guess what I would say is, of course it should be. So rates have been low. Why would anyone not have enough to pay their interest? They've just been refinancing. But now you're starting to get to a point where rates have gone up a bit. And there's two components of rates when you're a company. It's not just what the 10-year is doing or what the Fed is doing in the short end. It's also what premium the investor base wants for that money. So there's also a spread component. And so right now, treasury rates have come down pretty dramatically, but the spreads have remained pretty wide, at least at the high yield level. Investment grade, they're still tight. So if companies need to refinance and they need to refinance at higher and higher rates, interest coverage will come down. So what happens then? This is a chart that I saw that just left a really big impression on me. And basically what it says is, historically, and I would say it's pretty intuitive, but historically, when you take on more debt, you experience more losses at a nominal dollar level. And it makes sense. If there's just more debt in the system should be experiencing more losses. But you've seen recently is this divergence where debt has just gone up and up and up, and yet defaults remain muted. And if we know anything about humans is that they typically kind of extrapolate from their most recent experience for better or worse. And so people expect losses to remain low, at least, they mostly do. You would hope that if that was the case, that at least they were being prudent and asking for a better return on their investment, and yet more debt and spreads remain really low. That's also concerning because, you have more debt and you're getting less of a return for it. There's not a lot of competition among the suppliers of money for the rate, for the securities. That's not good if you're an investor. So naturally, companies are borrowing a lot, and leverage is at a 50-year high, and it makes sense because if you're a company and you are looking for cheap funding, you go to the debt market. Why issue equity? Lenders are expecting good times forever. They're not demanding with respect to their interest, so borrow from them as much as you can. And there are some companies that are terrific allocators of capital and take advantage of this, but the debt markets, there isn't a lot of kind of discerning between the good borrowers and the bad borrowers. So everyone's taking advantage of this. The covenants, which are the promises, the prenuptial agreement, if you will, that we talked about before, really are sort of the last stand. And you've seen the quality of those just get increasingly bad. And this is very concerning because if you're a lender and you're expecting losses to be low and you say, you know what, I'm also willing to take a low interest rate, you should all at least say, well, if things go bad, at least I have some protections and I can, you know, the assets can't get stolen from me. But the covenants are the worst that they've ever been. And you're seeing deals where assets are literally being stolen, the court will decide if they're being stolen, but they're being moved from a subsidiary or the box where the bonds are being held to another company or an unrestricted subsidiary, moving away from the securities. So you would hope that people who own bonds feel like their assets are at least protected, but they're not. And so the combination of more debt, lower expectations for defaults, lower interest rates, lower covenant quality, it's all just kind of a mess. And when times are good, no one really worries about it. And so I think for the intelligent, you know, investor who's thinking ahead, these are the times to be the most worried and to be the most prudent and to be the most discerning about where you're going to put your money, because other people aren't. And so you should be operating with an abundance of caution when you're investing in these securities, since everyone seems to be kind of giving their money away. Some simplified bond concepts to talk about, and then we'll go into a little bit of, you know, kind of some sample P&L of what it could look like. But, you know, when I talk about the duration of the bond, that's the price sensitivity to a change in interest rates. So if you have a bond like with high yield with a duration of 4 or investment grade, a duration of 8, it means that for a 4%, a bond will decline by 4% for high yield for every 100 basis point rate change. Investment grade for 100 basis point rate change, it'll be 8%. Now, this works for small changes in rates. And the area that people need to be focusing on, I think now more than ever, is convexity. And this is the price sensitivity to larger moves in rates. And it's the second derivative of the price yield relationship. And so why does it matter? Well, you know, typically, you know, these bonds were able to be refinanced. But what you're seeing is that as interest rates go up, their ability to refinance goes away. And so the duration of the bond actually could extend. So some bonds are priced yield to call. You should be looking at yield to worst and the ability for and depending on the ETF, it's modeled, you know, a whole bunch of different ways. But convexity kicks in and the bonds lengthen. The other thing is that when people start to get nervous and they start to sell the securities, I think generally speaking, investors have, you know, they like to think of things in a continuum where things move, you know, ever so, you know, smoothly. And anyone who's been in the credit markets, you know, I've been investing in the credit markets for really since the start, I was on the buy side. So, you know, 16 years, when things get bad, they move stepwise. I think any person in the credit markets probably has the scars to prove it. When things don't work, they sometimes work pretty badly and you have to be very careful. And so these securities, if they don't work, could gap down pretty quickly. And I think we saw that in December. And I think that was just a taste of what could be. And that shock among retail investors of what they own, that bonds do lose money, that there isn't a lot of liquidity, that the liquidity comes at a discount to NAV, that could be quite jarring. So this is just an example for high yield. And there's a lot of numbers on the page. And so I'm not going to go, you know, line by line. But what I would, the basic gist of it is, you know, you could put in when people, I always tell, you know, you could put whatever you want into a model and it'll spit out whatever you want it to. The general idea is I think that you're probably in an annual basis, when you're shorting high yield, you'll probably stand to lose, you know, 5 to 8%. You'll probably make if it kind of works, to working really well, somewhere between, 10 and 40%. And so in my opinion, you're not risking a whole lot, and you could make a good amount. Now, a way that we've been doing it is more through options, where you get some more leverage. So it's a little bit more ABX like, not quite as good as that, but you can still get some leverage if you set these up kind of on a longer term basis. And there's multiple ways that you can make money on this. You can make money because the duration extends. You can make money because, treasury rates widen. You can make money because spreads change, or default, people get worried that default rates are higher or that recoveries are lower, et cetera. So it's not just a bet on the overall U.S. Treasury rate. In fact, that's a small part of it. The reality is that spreads are still pretty tight. Loss rates are still expected to be pretty low. And if people get upset and things start to move in a bad direction, the way markets typically work, in my experience, is that people will over extrapolate to the down and things will look a lot worse. And then, my hope is that in some time there'll be a lot of opportunities on the credit side where you could buy very, very safe securities. And those same people who were buying them at low yields and low expectations of defaults are now going to think everyone's going to default, and they're going to, not be too interested in competing and buying these securities, and it'll be easier investing and easier money making for those of us who were patient. Investment grade credit is, something that I'm actually getting a lot more concerned about, just by the nature of the fact that you have real duration. So credit with junk credit, it's a 4-year duration, and it's certainly lousier companies, but with investment grade, they're trading at an absolute pretty tight yield of 4%, and you have an 8-year duration, so you can be less right, if you will, and there'll be a bigger multiplier in terms of the price just because of how long the bonds are. One area that I didn't touch on in the earlier slide is that, interestingly, as the Fed has raised short-term interest rates, the cash you get from shorting, I don't run my fund on leverage. So if you take the cash and go and I buy T-bills with it, 2 years ago, it didn't get you very much. But now with Fed funds, 2%+, you actually can make 2.5%, which when you're shorting high yield and it costs, about 7.5% coupon, you get about 2.5. So you get about a third of your money back. When you're shorting investment grade, you get even more, an even bigger percentage, but you get almost 50 or 60% back on investment grade. There's a typo. I wrote 30% negative carry. For investment grade, it's north of 50%, because you have a 4% cost of carry, and you're getting 2% back on the T-bill, or even maybe a little bit more. I think on investment grade, you can make many multiples of your investment for the same reasons you can make it on junk, but amplified a little bit because of the duration. So to wrap things up, I mean, in general, there are two kind of things going on here. You have the fundamental side of it, which is credit is still very, very tight. Spreads are tight. Expectations are, pretty positive, or at least maybe less so today than a few months ago. But still, people are not really being realistic about how bad things can get, and they're not taking the appropriate caution with these securities. And then the second part is just overall that this ETF structure is just not designed for pessimism, and it's not designed for lots of selling, and it may work for periods of time, but the reality is the system hasn't truly been tested, and when investors realize that what they own is not that liquid, and that you can't just create liquidity out of thin air, I think they'll be disappointed. I think they'll lose a lot of money, and they'll realize that it's not that easy to make 6, 7, 8% a year, and they never were. They were sort of borrowing from tomorrow to pay their coupon for today. And I think that some of this is pretty avoidable if people were prudent, but that's not the world. And so people want to try and make quote unquote easy money, and I think it will come to come to punish them at some point in the future. In the meantime, we wait and see kind of, you know, see where things shake out. So I appreciate the time, John, and you know, that wraps up things on my end.
Adam, thank you so much for that interesting presentation. You talked about the credit risk as well as the spreads and duration. How would you weigh those if one would have to kind of choose one of those bets to make? What do you think is it duration that's really the big bet to make here or something else?
Well, I think duration is sort of how you express it. So duration is just the byproduct of what you're buying or shorting. To me, it's really more of a function of defaults, expectations of defaults, and overall sort of spreads to treasuries. So, you know, you'll make less money if all of a sudden the Fed starts cutting rates and, the 10 years at 1%. But I would argue that a lot of people don't ask why that's happening. So if we're in a situation at, you know, where the 10 years at 1%, I would argue that things are probably not going so well in the economy and companies may not be producing the kind of cash that they need in order to satisfy and pay their debt obligations. So, the why is as important as kind of the what, the duration. To me is kind of a byproduct of all of it. I'm not sure it's why there's a way to kind of express it, except you could choose to short, you know, investment grade, which has a bigger duration component than high yield.
I'm wondering if there's a way to express this without incurring the annual cost, obviously maybe not with that kind of leverage or that directly, but are you aware of any other ways that one can even just tangentially express this view while basically breaking even in the meantime?
I think it's pretty hard to do that. I mean, the closest thing to that is if you short an investment grade credit and it costs you 4% and you get half of it back via T-bills. You know, when I was looking at, the ABX and looking at it as a short, this is prior to joining Firtree, I got pushback from people that the cost, you know, was prohibitive. And sometimes if you can look at it in a couple different ways, if you're buying particularly, you know, I own a lot of equities, or not a lot, I own 10, but I have a big percentage of my portfolio is long equities. Some of them have leverage in them. I look at this both as an outright short that I like to have on that's asymmetric, but I also view it as a little bit like buying, you know, house insurance. And if things get a little bad, I like knowing that I'm not paying a lot for this insurance. And if for whatever reason my equities do great and the insurance that I'm spending money on, the premiums, if you will, go to naught, such as life. You know, you don't see people ruining the day that they pay their insurance premiums and their house didn't burn down, so they didn't collect on the bet. So this is, to me, both an outright interesting idea. Also, anyone who owns levered equities, I think it's a no-brainer, personally, at least for a portion of their portfolio. But things cost, you know, if you want to be short something, there's usually some cost to it. If someone figures out a way to do it, you know, more cheaply, you know, one way of doing it is via options, but you do have the decay. You can figure out how much you're willing to lose over a period of time and buy options with a longer expiration and just use that as a fixed carry cost. But, you know, I don't have a great answer. If you figure it out, I'd like to be your first phone call.
Well, I was just thinking maybe there are some companies that could benefit from a wave of defaults or rates going up, you know, maybe some little investment bank that's focused just on restructuring these types of securities or what have you. But
Yeah, I mean,
clearly.
sure. That means maybe even someone like Oak Tree or someone that benefits from things like that. But to me, that's a little bit, that's like kind of the second derivative of the investment, which is could be a great idea. But like you'll need it to come to pass, and then you'll need them to do what they do, and then you'll need time to, you know, for them to realize the value, because these things do take time. So I think it's a really good idea to look at those. I probably should. But so far, to me, this is the most direct way, and it's never really bothered me for whatever reason to pay a little bit, you know, for something where I think I can make, you know, 3, 5 plus, you know, I think in investment grade, you can make 10 times your money on some of these, in some circumstances. To me, it's not, you know, the carry cost is something that I can live with.
Makes sense. Last year, we actually had a Bogomil Baranovsky talk about going long the ProShares short high yield ETF, ticker SJB. Are you familiar with that one at all?
I am. Yeah, I enjoyed his presentation. I actually thought it was well done. That's, you could express it that way. That's just the inverse of the long ETF. So it's more or less this. It should perform roughly the same. I didn't spend a lot of time looking at this because I'm structuring this mostly via options. But you know, there may be a way of doing it cheaper, you know, through being you'd buy calls on that, since it's an inverse ETF, from my understanding. But it's largely conceptually, I think, similar to what he was talking about.
Right. Okay. Well, Adam, thank you again for such a truly differentiated idea. Appreciate you bringing this to us and sharing your research with our community.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an honor to be, you know, in the group and to share with people. And you know, I'm looking forward to both any words of encouragement from people who agree, but probably more so anyone who disagrees. I'm always open to hearing the disagreement and sort of pushing me a bit on it. Could only wind up with a better process that way. So I'm looking forward to that too.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, we're certainly happy to facilitate an introduction as appropriate.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Goodbye for now.
All right. Bye.